Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
We are all aware of the power of money, how it influences our moods, compels us to take risks, and serves as the yardstick of success. Yet, because we take the daily reality of money so completely for granted, we seldom question how and why it has come to play such a central role in our lives. In the new book, Coined, The Rich Life of Money and How Its History Has Shaped Us, author Kabir Segal casts aside our workaday assumptions about money and takes the reader on a quest to understand the relationship between money and humankind. It is not only a discussion of the concept of money, but it is also a take on the nature of humanity and the inner workings of the mind. Kabir Segal is a vice president in emerging market equities at J.P. Morgan in New York. He serves as an officer in the United States Navy Reserve, served as a speechwriter for John Kerry's presidential campaign, and is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Again, the title of the book is Coined, and we welcome Kabir Segal to the program this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Joe, really a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Very nice to have you on the program and to have you join us. The idea of exploring money and the concept of money this way, what brought you to that?
I started working on Wall Street just a few months before the credit crisis began, and I was just really shocked with the devastation that it caused, not just the people here are losing their jobs on Wall Street, but on Main Street, people losing their houses, and also throughout the emerging world, people, America, whatever happens in America really affects other places. And so I wanted to know, why are people so irrational? Why are people act so bizarrely when it comes to money? And sort of the question I asked myself was, what's happening in the mind when we deal with money, when we think about money, when we spend money? And that led me to, down the rabbit hole, and I eventually ended up in the field called neuroeconomics. And I found that there's some incredible things happening in the brain when you're using money. For example, you scan people's brains who are making money, and then you compare it to people who are high on cocaine, and they look virtually the same. When I say the word money to you, it's having a physiological change on you, meaning that your skin conductancy is increasing, that the mere idea of making money excites you. When you touch money, people report feeling less pain. People count money and they stick their finger in hot, scalding water, and there's less pain. So I was really intrigued that there's a biological reason for why we make some of these crazy and irrational financial decisions.
And is that because of its value of what it is worth to us and what it can, quote, buy us?
Absolutely. And the thing about money is that there's a genetic reason why we exchange. I mean, scientists have gone back, and we've always wanted to exchange things of value, and so they've been able to find specific genes. There's one gene in particular, and there are two variants of this one gene. And if you have one variant of it, you're more likely to donate money to charities. You're more likely to be more benevolent and to exchange with other people. And if you have the other variant, you're not as likely to do that. But across all of humanity, we all possess a gene set that makes us more likely to exchange and more likely to have value, to deal in things of value with each other. And so, but the thing is, Joe, is I think that this idea of money is so different all around the world. I traveled to over 25 countries. My job takes me all over the world, and people have different ideas about what value is and what money is. And for example, I was in Tokyo not too long ago, and I bought some fruit for some friends, and I gave them some fruit, and my friend says, Kabir, I cannot accept this present from you. I said, why not? He said, because you're leaving tomorrow, and I'll never be able to repay you. And so the word in Japanese for thank you, arigato, means this difficult thing. There's another word, sumisen, which means I am so sorry, I cannot accept this. When you give a present to someone in Japan at their wedding, you have to make sure that the ribbon is tied strongly, because otherwise, if it's tied too loosely, they may think that you're sending the symbol, sending the message that you don't think their wedding is going to last. So why do I bring this example up? It's because in this culture in Japan, they have a very different idea of value, very different idea about what exchange is and how to exchange. And so money really requires an anthropological lens to understand it throughout society.
So in our society, you talk about gifts, and that gifts are a currency as well.
That's right. Think about when you give someone a gift, you're not just giving them a gift, you're tying them to an obligation. And so, you know, I go out to have drinks with my friends on occasion after work, and I thought I'd try a silly social experiment. So everyone bought a round of beers, and then the time came for me to pay for my round. And I said, guys, I'm not going to pay for my drinks. And they said, well, what are you talking about? We just bought our rounds. You got to pay for your rounds. And I said, no, not going to do it. And it made me look silly, but I used it. And of course, I joked away. I said, oh, just kidding. But what happened there? I went from being kind of like a stand-up guy, being invited to this, I guess, watering hole with my friends.
Right.
And within one moment, I violated this gift, the gift economy, and I was seen as an outsider. And so this, we even talk about it. When you say, I owe you, or you owe me, or I invested in that relationship, money's really shaping how we see our friends and relationships. And so, you know, there's one Wall Street CEO who keeps a list in his suit pocket. On one side of it, it says, who owes me? On the other side, it's who do I owe? Yeah. So the gift economy really greases the wheels for the market economy.
And that comes down, which isn't often thought of when we're talking about banking and Wall Street, which is fairness, right? Of what is fair?
Yeah, I mean, fairness is a question because, you know, throughout the history of money, and I went to so many countries and I looked at the history of money for 4,000 years, over 4,000 years, and usually the person who issues the money wants to control it. That's where you get the invention of paper money. And so I went to Mongolia and I saw the ancient seat of power of Kublai Khan and the great Khan empires. And the reason I went there is because Marco Polo spoke about Kublai Khan and how he would issue paper money out of the barks of trees. And if anyone who would question his authority, he would put them to death. Anyone who would question his money, he would put them to death. And why do I bring that up? Because the Mongols had a huge empire, and the only way they could, you know, administer policy was through paper money. And so they were basically controlling the money supply. And so by controlling the money supply, you can effectively control people's investment decisions, people's financial decisions, and that raises questions of fairness. You know, so a lot of people say, well, the power of making money should not be vested in the issuer. It should not be vested in Kublai Khan. It should not be vested in the Fed. It should be invested in gold. It should be invested in in other words, the money itself should have value. It shouldn't be an article of faith by the person who issued it in the first place. So the issues of fairness is really a question that comes out throughout the history of money.
You discuss this in the book, and I found it fascinating, especially on the heels of your earlier statement about how we physically react to money when we touch it, and the neuroscience of what happens when we are near it and we have it in our hands. So that brings us to the question of the future of money, and I guess I think of this because you're also talking about a book of we can buy this book and we can buy it in a brick and mortar store and we can have it in our hands, or we can also have a digital copy of it. Does that idea of money of cyber cash, does that change our relationship with money?
I think so. I mean, in the book, I talk about the future of money and what you know when you don't. 85% of the world's transactions are still in cash, right? And so. And that's not just in the emerging world. So in India and China, it's very difficult to pay with a credit card. But there's also in developed countries like Germany and Japan, there's very, very few, there's very small penetration of credit cards there. And there's cultural reasons. For example, in Germany, the word for debt is Schuld, which means guilt or sin. And so there's cultural reasons why credit cards are not percolated in these areas. But one of the technologies that is abundant are mobile phones. So turning the mobile phone into a payment device, for example, the Economist observed that it's easier to pay for a taxi in Nairobi than it is in New York using your cell phone, because they have this great mobile phone technology where you can pay via SMS. But you asked about, does this change our relationship with money? Absolutely. You look what happens in the United States. When you don't see the money, when you don't take that money and give it to the cashier, the part of your brain that usually activates when you're spending money is the insula. It's involved in the fear center, or fear or feelings of anxiety. And so when you don't see the money, when it's just a credit card transaction or just you're just touching your phone, there's less activation in the insula, meaning there's less fear, there's less anxiety, which is probably good for a Starbucks or any store trying to get you to pay more money, because they're not activating those parts of your brain. And so there's a lot of some companies have gotten into trouble for this. So Apple was involved in a class action lawsuit because a lot of kids, you know, when on your iPhone it stores your credit card information,
right,
so they keep on racking up and buying more and more songs, and so they rack up these huge bills, and so Apple got in trouble for I guess storing that and they're still trying to come up with a resolution, but absolutely not being able to see the money changes our relationship with money.
So as we wrap up here, tell me how in the world researchers found traces of a white rhinoceros on cash that was circulating in Manhattan.
Well, money is very, very filthy, and so for many reasons.
But are we rubbing it on rhinoceroses? Like, how does that happen?
Yeah, that I don't know. I think I don't know. I mean, there's a study. I go into it in the book with some detail. They found that all kinds of microbes involved with pneumonia and acne, but also there was, 50% of the DNA traces were non-human, so dogs and even traces of white rhinoceros. Maybe someone was at the Bronx Zoo.
Out at the zoo, sure.
Yeah.
That's what they're doing. It's a really fascinating look, and makes you think of things that you've never thought of before and think of things in a whole new way. The book is Coined, The Rich Life of Money and How Its History Has Shaped Us. The book is published by Grand Central. Kabir Segal, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. Very nice to have you with us.
Likewise. Thanks so much.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book is Coined, The Rich Life of Money and How Its History Has Shaped Us, published by Grand Central, by Kabir Segal. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.